All right, so would everybody please help me welcome our speaker tonight? It is Anthony C. from Bel Air, Maryland, and his home group is the Primary Purpose Speakers Group.
I never picked a sobriety date on a Friday and waste a good weekend. I know that. You can always get a good scam going on a weekend. There was always a few dollars to rob off the bar. Hustle a few dollars up and get the weekend in. My home group's the Primary Purpose Speakers Group. We started that group in January. We were a member of a Sunday night group in a town in Bel Air, Maryland. We got involved in that group about 3 years ago, and it blossomed to about 40, 45 active group members, young members in Alcoholics Anonymous. In that group, we took about 7-8 institution commitments, and we're in about 5 different institutions a week. And that room was buzzing. And about 2 or 3 of us decided we didn't want to change the format there, and we really liked the speaker meeting. We didn't have many. I can't see them. No. And we decided that we wanted a speaker meeting. We didn't want to change the format. Now, my one home group, the speakers group, is a 10-minute speaker on the topic of primary purpose, followed by a short break. Right before that short break, we asked anybody within their first 30 days or without a sponsor to raise their hand. These poor kids have no idea what they're about to do when they raise their hand. Because in that short break, there was guys that have been through the 12 steps, current in amends, and looking for people to help. And they're getting attacked. It's like just shooting fish in a barrel. That's what it's like. And those guys never walk out of that meeting without a sponsor, without somebody and a couple phone numbers and somebody picking them up the next day. Do you know how many meetings I walked in and out of in my 15, 16 years of coming in and introducing myself and people walk by me like I was the plague? How many times that happened? Or they'd walk up to me and say, hey, you want to go to the diner? I go to the diner, we're talking about everything else but what I'm suffering from, right? And I'm not blaming them people. What I know today is that sobriety date I have, I still to this day cannot believe I'm sober. I cannot believe. There's about 3-4 times a day where I'll just be in the middle thinking to myself. And then all of a sudden I'll go, oh my God, I'm sober. That was not the plan. I don't know, maybe you picked your sobriety date. I ain't good at picking them. So I can't believe it. I've been given God's grace, which is an unmerited gift, and who the hell am I to sit on my ass and go to the gym and find balance and work on myself? And that nonsense. I worked on myself for 33 damn years, and it ended me up almost dead. And what happened was I got involved this time, and I went through whatever process I did, and the thought of others became my constant thought. And it's the only way I've ever found relief from what I suffer from. Yeah, I suffer from alcoholism, but the only time I'm worried about alcohol is when I'm drinking it, right? Well, what about when I'm not drinking it? The only thing I do is think of myself. And the only way I know how to get out of that is thinking of others, right? And the only way I know how to strengthen my relationship with God is through helping God's kids. Seems radical to some people. Don't you need some time for yourself? I've tried that. Don't work for me. So that home group, and we bring in like-minded speakers that are going to talk about caring in amends and helping others. That's what I'm looking for. And a definition of alcoholism. And I don't want a drinking problem. I don't want to hear about your drinking problems. Stop drinking. Anybody ever try stop drinking? I sucked at it, to be honest with you. I was never good at not drinking. And the other meeting we have in that home group on Thursday nights is a format called Breaking Down the Book. 2 lines to a paragraph at a time, and we get into the meat and potatoes of that book. Absolutely love it. I've heard it before. Alcoholics have been hanging out together forever, for centuries. But when 2 alcoholics or more meet for the purpose of recovery, God's there. And that's what I see happening in that room when that book opens. And there's just things in there. You ever read Bill's story when you don't want to be sober? It sucks. When you don't want to be so, the only time I laugh in Bill's story when it said pot, I would go, pot, I knew he smoked. I didn't even know that's not what it meant. Read that story for the purpose of recovery and watch what happens. One of the best drunkologues ever, right? Get into the forward, second, third edition, you know, forwards, and start learning about the history. What? Who wanted to know about the history of AA? I never did. I didn't want to know that. I found it's the easiest way to explain how God works in AA and how the different circumstances happen. That there's no coincidences in Alcoholics Anonymous how we got here and how this thing works. So we use that book. Now, I'm here to tell you, when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous the first time at 22 years old, I could memorize the book. I still drank. You know? I didn't take any of the action. But I gave good share. I did. You ever go to a meeting? I had my share dialed in and ready for the meeting 15 minutes before I got there. And I would wait until after the basket was passed because I didn't want to be interrupted. Huh? That's the kind of sick pup I was coming out of AA. I don't know about you, but I had mine dialed in with about 4 Red Bulls before I got there. I wanted to be extra peppy, you know, and I start yelling at them, you know. And scary part was I didn't even know what an alcoholic was. But I gave good share. Page 88, line 8. Ha ha. Page 112, first 3 words. It works, it really does. Read this book, you know. I still drank knowing that. So I don't get lost in the book, but I'll tell you why we started that meeting. Because I started getting very active in Alcoholics Anonymous and helping others, and what I chose to do was not have time for the big book. So what I start doing is telling these young guys what I think maybe they should read and denying them the opportunity of going through that book. Now, that's a dangerous place to be sometimes, you know, and sometimes I forget it's not me doing this. That's the story on the home groups. I was born and raised in South Philadelphia, down by the stadiums. I wasn't raised by wolves. They were good people, you know what I mean? I was born and raised in an Irish-Italian Catholic family. I'm not a recovering Catholic. I got no issues with the Catholic Church, right? I was an altar boy at 8, and the only reason why I was an altar boy was so I could rob the basket. That was it. That's what my whole neighborhood did. We robbed the basket, and then the older guys, like the 8th graders, would tell us what masses to work, and we'd go to their house and give them a kickback from the basket, right? I never suffered from feeling like a failure as a kid because I had zero ambitions.
None.
My goal in life was to sit on the corner in a beach chair, wear a pinky ring, and drive a Cadillac. That was it. College, why would I want to do 4 more years of something I didn't want to do the first 12? Right? Why? I don't get that. And I hear a lot of speakers, when they're speaking out of state or out of town, they were the best athletes. You ever notice that? Everybody was valedictorian, Wayne Gretzky, and Pele in soccer. Let me just cut the bullshit right now. I hated basketball. I could never understand if there was a court right here, why I'd run down the other end. I could never understand that. Right? I could never understand. I just had no ambition. I'm going to tell you another thing. And I hear speakers talk about this all the time, and I almost start lying and saying it. I sponsor a lot of people identify this way, and I know a lot of people. I'm going to hear you there now. I didn't feel weird as a kid. I'm going to tell you what, I kind of liked me. Probably too much. When I didn't walk into like the 4th grade, walk in and go, oh my God, I got a long neck and a big nose, and I'm frequently tall. Give me a drink. No, I didn't do that. I thought everybody was waiting for me, to be honest with you. I just fit right in. That don't make me an alcoholic. That don't make me an alcoholic. I know later on in my story that I had an allergic reaction to alcohol, and I really liked it. And I loved the effects produced by alcohol because there was more of me. You think I'm obnoxious now, you should see me drinking. I was an obnoxious kid, and then I drank. And I'll tell you what happened was I continued to drink, and I continued to rip and run, lie, cheat, and steal, have resentments, continue to be self-consumed constantly. A list of fears grew that I didn't even know I had. I had a sexual conduct list from here to back to Maryland. It was atrocious. Some of it was fun, though. And a lot of defects, right? A lot of them. Had a lot of them, right? They were starting to block me off. And then I had a whole list of people I trashed, completely separated myself from everyone in my life. And then I had a whole nother period of where I had to go make these things right. And that is what blocked me off from God. So I don't know how disconnected I was as a kid, but I'll tell you what. Phew, drinking and drugging sure did speed up the process, I'll tell you that. And I would sit in AA for years, everybody not feeling right. And I believe that to be true. But I couldn't identify that way. And I looked hard. I mean, I got about 32 four-steps in my history. and I couldn't find, I didn't say sober through all of them, but I wrote a lot of them. And I used to like the confessional four-step. Or you just go tell when you got, like, in a circle jerk when you were a kid or something like that. You know, like that stuff. You know, that's the kind of four-step I liked. I liked penance. I didn't mind. I used to like shocking the priest. I'd make shit up. I go in and see if I can get him to squirm, like, in the other side of the booth, you know? And that's the kind. I come at it with three rosaries to do. You know what I mean? Like, everybody else had two Our Fathers and a Hail Mary. I had four rosaries. And that's the kind of kid I was. I liked that kind of stuff. And, you know, around 15 years old, I caught my first case, and I went away for 2 years. And I like to tell you, my first drinking story isn't much, but I do tell it. I grew up around the bars in South Philly. My uncle was a bartender, and my whole family ran around the bars in South Philly. As a kid, I grew up hanging there in the summers, bringing up ice and bringing up cases of beer. I used to write the street number on the chalkboard one at a time as they came in. My heroes were gangsters. They were not. I could not understand the people walking to the subway to go to work. I would look at them and go, what a schmuck. Why would you do that? You just go hang in the bar. These guys drive Cadillacs. That's my perception of life. And so the first time this lady died in an apartment, my uncle said, I'll give you $20 to go clean the apartment. I go over there to clean the apartment. He comes over with $20 and a six-pack of Busch beer in the can. Oh, I started at rock bottom. What I found out that night was that I have an allergic reaction to alcohol. I drank all six. What I found out the next morning is I hate the effects produced by alcohol the next morning. A migraine and violently ill. So what I proceeded to do was drugs, and lots of them, and I liked them. And if there's any tradition Nazis in this room, I used to be one, and it's a lonely island inside Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to tell you right now, it ain't my problem, drinking and drugs. But I'm not going to sit here and tell you how I robbed my mother, abandoned my children, lost my home, lost everything else, and go, oh, I'm sorry, by the way, I smoked a joint. I'm not doing that. I'm not going to do that. They were the solution to the problem that I end up having, right? And I ain't going to talk about them much more. I'm certainly not going to apologize for it or make key words. I snorted Budweiser. No, I'm not going to get into that. I'm not going to get into that. I'm going to be honest. I'm going to share my experience, strength, and hope, what it was like for me and my journey. And so I did them for years. And so I did my time. And in those 2 years, see, in those 2 years when I was sitting in there, waiting to get out. Do you know I could stay reasonably content sober as long as I know there's an expiration date on the sobriety? Like, if I had that conditional sobriety, or just like, so you're telling me, like, all I got to do is get out of trouble and wait. As long as I know there's a drink or something at the end of that, I can kind of be okay for quite an extended period of time, especially when I'm young. Now, as I get older, the length of time in between drink, the length of time of sobriety that I can feel comfortable in shorten and get shorter and get shorter until the end where it was 3 days, and I could not stand how I was living. I could not stand sobriety, and I had no idea what I was suffering from. So for 2 years when I'm sitting there, the only thing I could think about is getting out and getting loaded. But I was not sitting there going, oh, my God, I got a mental obsession. No, dude. It says it. The alcoholic life seemed to be the only normal one. That's all I thought about. From like 4 years old to 15, I thought about me and what me was going to do, where me was going to go, what everybody was going to do for me, and I wondered about me and thought about me, and then I added drinks and drugs. So then from 15 to like 31, the only thing I thought about was me drinks and drugs. Me drinks and drugs. That's it. That's all I thought about. There was really nothing else going on in my life besides that. And I got out right before I turned 18 and I drank. And I like to tell you that there was like this internal spring that was wound tight. And I drank and it got loose. I'd be lying. I'm going to tell you what happened. I drank and I liked it. That was it. I don't have this deep philosophy type mind that can go back all the way through my childhood and explain every instance in my life. I could tell you what. I loved drinking. I loved it. And that's all I know. That's all I know. And when I got out, I drank. And you know what else happened? When I got out, I drank, nothing happened. I didn't get in trouble. Nothing happened. I got out. I went back to hanging on the corner, and I was pretty quite content with my life. And damn cops always seem to show up at the wrong time. I caught another case, and I ran to one of them halfway houses, one of them beautiful ones in Kensington. And beautiful town, looks just like Beirut. And right before I went in there, I was playing poker one night, and the fill-in waitress came. Her name was Jackie at the time. I fell in love. Then I introduced myself, and our relationship was perfect, 2 a.m. to 6 a.m., my kind of woman, you know, for that time, and it was going great. Caught that case, ended up in Kensington at a halfway house. At this time, my mother filed a divorce. I get in there, she calls me, she says, I'm pregnant. Oh, by the way, I found that her name was Ann right before I went in. Jackie was her stage name, so I now knew her first name, and then she told me she was pregnant. And my response to that is, woo, going to be a daddy, going to be a daddy. How do you fix a bad relationship? Have a kid. What's next? Get married. That's how I think. That's how I came in. I don't have like a clear, I don't have this type of relationship where she's one of my sisters in God's world and I should learn how to treat her with love and things like that. Man, I don't know that stuff. I'm thinking to myself, finally, I got a bad life going here. Maybe have a kid to straighten me up. Well, I'm sitting in that halfway house, and my mother finally talked to me for a while, and they come visit me. My mother, who I always consider dramatic and a pain in the ass, turns a corner, and she's crying. Here's my first thought. I'm looking at her going, will you stop ruining my moment? I'm making you a grandmother, and you're going to ruin my moment. That's how I look at her. That's how I perceive. And I tell this story not just to be funny, but to show how deep and sick my level of selfishness and self-centeredness will take me. Do you understand for almost my whole life, if you don't agree with me, you're wrong? I really thought I was the axis of the universe. I really did. That's like carrying an anchor through life. When nobody else agrees with what you think or do, it's a real pain. You know, I never knew I had that until about 2 years sober this time. Whew. My first 2 years sucked. I'll tell you right now. I didn't even know what selfishness meant until about my two-year anniversary. I thought I was a martyr. And, you know, so I go through, and my father turns the corner. He goes, my mother's name's Cookie. And he goes, Cook, calm down, calm down. He said, what's your name? My father's like the placator. I learned that in all my years of therapy. That was his title, the placator. And, somebody's been to therapy. Who's laughing? I got a few therapeutics here, I know. And I used to be one. Talk about my favorite subject, me. Sit in group therapy and talk about you. And never worked. And my father said, Aunt, what's your name? I said, phew, Ann. He said, good. He said, what'd she do? I said, she's in sales. He says, all right, good. He said, where's she from? I said, she's from Jersey. She lives in Philly. He goes, good. He said, what's her last name? I said, I don't know, Dad, never came up. Here's my mother on a picnic bench. She's screaming like that. And still, my mind's telling me, will you stop? It's not like a stork's going to drop his kid off next week. I got 9 months to get my life together. Here's my resume at that point. 2 years, convicted felon, high school dropout, about 6 loony bins, and a couple rehabs. My perception looks at her like she's nuts. You're ruining my moment. I used to tell a story about how my mother woke me up like it was a fire drill every morning. That the cereal was soggy. She used to pour my toad on it, turned into oatmeal. She was always screaming. Because I didn't wake up the first 17 times she woke me up. Right? She poured the cereal. It was perfect. I didn't wake up for another half hour. But that's not what my mind tells me. My mind tells me that my mother's a pain in the ass my whole life. That lady has never given up on me. Her prayers are why I'm here. Never, when nobody left on this earth would talk to me, I couldn't get her away from me. And I still didn't like her. Will you just leave me alone? That's what I used to say. Thank God she never did. And, so some good. You know, it wasn't so much the fourth step that helped. It was a different perspective on the fifth step. And thank God I'm a victim of good sponsorship. Can't stand them sometimes, man. You really go in there with your perception, you come out totally shattered. You know what I mean? And you come out with an amends, too. You know what I mean? It's like, man, I've been thinking this way for like 34 years. You tell me I'm wrong, and I got to make it right. Oh, my God. You know, please. And So I get out of there. When you live in South Philly, the South Philly dream is to buy a house in Jersey, anywhere but Camden. 21 years old, I got a job down at Philadelphia Shipyard. I become a structural steel foreman. Bookmaking, loan sharking, selling drugs down there. Go right back to drinking and drugging. Making a ton of money. Buy a house over the bridge. Beautiful little house. Have another kid. We get married. Move out there. Now, I don't have that alcoholic house. I got like soys of grass. I learned how to thatch, aerate, all kinds of shit. Planted rose bushes. I decorate inside and out for every holiday. You are not going to tell me I'm an alcoholic. You look, Ma, I made it. Ha ha. So I have a day. 21 years old. And it was kind of hard to break the delusion I had going. Because, you know, every time I come in AA, I think a set of outside circumstances what makes me an alcoholic. All the time, man. I will always come in and think that because I lost everything, that's what makes me an alcoholic. So you fast forward, and I start ripping apart my marriage. I start being that phony father, where the only time I'm smiling or like my kids or my wife are when people are looking. I'm verbally, mentally, and physically abusive to my wife. I'm a complete disconnect from anybody in my life. And I start to distance myself from everybody. You know, my wife would get involved with my drinking and drugging. And if you kind of like interfered with anything I like to do, you're out. That was my thing. I protected my alcohol. I don't even know how to explain it sometimes. Because when I start to talk about it, I think back to where I was and how free I am today. And I am baffled, man. I am absolutely baffled of how my life has radically changed from them. But when I look back, I held them people hostage. I held them people hostage. And I fast forward. Coming over the bridge one day in 2000, whatever it was, early 2000, like 23, 24 years old, and I get this crazy idea. You should get sober. I'm thinking, whoa, where'd that come from? And at this time, the mortgage is paid, everything's done, the house looks good, grass is mowed. I'm on Chrysler Town and Countries with the soccer sticker on the back, doing that cheer dad. I like cheer dad, actually. Like that drunk or sober. I hated T-ball. That sucked. And untreated alcoholism, T-ball is the worst sport ever. It's like watching paint dry, and you got a fake smile, and you want to choke every other parent. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, why you root for that kid? He sucks. You know, that's what I would. Now, I wish, having gone through the 12 steps, made some amends, had a relationship with God, I could go back and do those things. Thank God I ain't got to be challenged with T-ball again, though. But, so I would keep up with the Joneses, and one day I decided to get sober. So I go to my union, they send me to a police assistance program. They recommend I go to rehab after work, which is outpatient therapy, which is group. I go see the doctor. He diagnosed me about 12 different things, none of which I can get a disability check for, which really pissed me off. About six different medications, and I join a clubhouse in South Jersey, and I start making regular attendance and meetings. So here's my sobriety. Group therapy, which you already know is my favorite thing. My commitment to group therapy was for 6 months. I stayed a year and a half because I really liked it. I became group leader. You know, and I start counseling everybody in the group. Here I am on my meds. I got no opinion on meds, but I do have my experience. Me on meds is like this. That's the extent of my ups and downs. I was like in a perpetual pot stage. I just like, couldn't get a shift. Either way, problem is after about a year and a half, the damn things have a side effect in the bedroom, and my wife found them objectionable. So did I. And so I got about a year and a half sober. Now I'm in group therapy, regular tens of meetings, quoting the big book, getting there early, smoking and joking, laughing, whistling at women, and gossiping. Playing poker in the clubhouse, and every once in a while, a meeting would interrupt the poker game. And we'd have to go to the meeting, and I'd go back to playing poker. And around 18 months, 19 months, I come off antidepressants. I was good for about a month or two, and then I was about right before my 2-year anniversary, I was starting to lose my mind. And here's the worst delusion I ever got into in sobriety, was that I thought I was doing AA. I thought making meetings. I thought my group therapy. I thought the consistent thought of myself and working on myself was the answer to my problem. and avoidance, avoiding triggers. You know what the trigger I had was? Consciousness. If my eyes were open, that was a trigger. Trigger. What a crock of shit that is, anyway. So I'm avoiding triggers, I'm going to group therapy, I'm off my medication, and I'm ready to kill somebody. And I'm thinking to myself, if you keep telling me paralysis is every time I drink I can't stop, well then stop drinking. Well, I'm not drinking no more. Unmanageability, everything I do after I drink. Stop drinking. I'm not drinking no more. I'm not suffering from a drinking problem at 20-something months sober. And then I hear this crazy stuff. Hang in there, kid. You get that 2-year chip. You put it in your mouth and wait for it to dissolve. What? I'll chop that thing up and snort it. Don't tell me that. Don't tell me that. Shoot for midnight, kid. Did you ever try shoot for midnight in unstreet alcoholism? I need handle grips on my armchair to do that. And they start telling me this. Just make another meeting. Let go. Let God. What does that mean? You got anything else? Make another meeting. I made 6 today, cuz. Tell me make another one. I'm going to kill you. That's what I'm going to do. So I wait for that 2-year chip, and the 2-year chip I celebrate with a beer. And that's the first time alcohol worked for my spiritual condition. That's the first time I went, why the hell did I just waste 2 years trying to get sober? That was my first thought. And I start drinking with my dad in South Philly, and he looks at me one day, and here's my arrival moment. He looks at me and said, I can finally have a drink with my son. You're not a junkie no more. I said, phew, finally. You know, it's a real pain in the ass when you're trying to drink and your whole family don't want you to drink. You know, like hide it and shit. You know what I mean? Like you got to fake go to the bathroom and order a double at the bar and then come back and drink. When you're out with your wife, you got to order Pinot for fish and red for pasta. It's such a pain. You know, I don't drink like that. I don't drink like that. I like to get smashed. I'm not a social drinker. I wasn't even a social drinker when I didn't like alcohol. I still had an allergic reaction. I had no idea when I was going to stop. And so I acquired a quick taste for vodka. I liked it a lot. Here's some of the conversations I used to have. I was drinking cranberry vodka, and I started peeing a lot, and my bladder was bothering me. And I had a guy at the bar telling me it's that cranberry. I said, you know what? You're probably right. So I cut out the cranberry. That was it, man. And I had guys like agreeing with that solution. It's the cranberry. These are the kind of guys I was running with, right? And I start calling out of work. One time I called out 4 different times in the same night with 4 different excuses. And down at the shipyard, they had that thing where they could log them on the computer, your voicemails. And I showed up on Tuesday and thought it was Monday. And I was wondering why he was pissed. And then I found out it was Tuesday, and I thought that was why. And then he told me, well, do you remember calling out Thursday? And I go, yeah. He says, you want to hear them? I said, here, what do you mean them? He said, all 4 of your excuses with the jukebox playing in the back? I went, oh. Oh, man. Yeah, let's hear them. You know what I mean? Like, you firing me? You know what I mean? If you're not going to fire me, I want to listen to them. I was the kind of guy that liked blackouts. I loved them. One time I won gambling, blacking out. My answer to gambling was blackout first. That didn't work long. But it did work twice, which was the worst thing that could happen because I really thought it was a scientific fact that I would always win. So anyway, I get to September 2000. Oh, I get to beginning of 2010, and I start coming in AA, man. And I'm trying to get like 3 days. And I'm getting 7 days. And I'm drinking. I'm on a marijuana maintenance thing. I'm dying, man. I'm dying. And I'll tell you what, I used to take a lot of shots at problem drinkers and stuff like that and think it was their fault. It wasn't their fault, man. I don't know what the hell anybody is. All I know is I'm suffering from something that just not drinking doesn't fix. And just making another meeting doesn't fix. Now, I'm an excessive meeting maker. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I travel all over the place. I drive further to listen than I do to talk. I like this stuff. I make a meeting every day. I make an excessive amount of meetings on the weekend if I have the time. But I'm not making a meeting because I need a meeting. I'm making a meeting because I enjoy and love the things I hear in Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in it, and that's where I find the easiest way to find people to help. All right? But when I'm suffering from untreated alcoholism, I'm relying on meetings to keep me sober. When you suffer from what I suffer from, oh, I don't last long. And I'm coming in, and I'm coming out, and now here's the real pain in the ass part. You don't want to hear at the end, and everybody's calling you. What are you doing? Where are you at? How many days you got? Make a meeting? What are you doing tomorrow? Or you're at the bar, and you're thinking about AA, and you're in AA thinking about the bar. And it really sucks, man. It's just like this wet blanket. And then you get to the part where you're looking at your phone, and all the voicemail boxes are jammed. No more text messages come through. You start turning the ringer off. Then you got to turn the whole phone off because it's lighting up and the vibrator's scaring you on the phone. You know what I mean? You're just like, oh, my God, but they just leave me alone. I tell you, I fixed that in 2010. I went on a suicide run. And I'll tell you what. When I realized that getting sober was the problem, trying to get sober, when I realized I wasn't going to try and get sober no more, I drank with a free and clear conscience. The problem was trying to get sober for me. The problem wasn't drinking. The problem was trying to get sober for everybody that was asking me to get sober. And I start answering that phone when people will call. They say, where are you at? I've been up for 12 days. I'm in Atlantic City. What do you want? Hello? Okay, call me later. Click. I would answer the phone. They stop calling once you answer the phone. And that brings me to September 27, 2010. And when drug addicts, alcoholics die, we hear the grieving process normally the same. He's in a better place now. His children don't have to worry. His mother don't have to worry. He's at peace. And that was what I thought of that day. I was like, you know what? I can't do this no more, man. I can't do it. The alcohol stopped working. Everything stopped working. I couldn't function. And I was going to pull a cop out. I was going to pull a gun out in the cops. They were looking for me. And I ended up blinking. Next thing I know, I'm wrapped up like a damn pretzel. This leg is handcuffed to this arm like this. Damn me, like some kind of contortionist. And next thing I got this canine barking at my face. I'm getting drooled on. Now, I just wanted to kill myself, and I come to, and I'm wrapped up like a pretzel with this dog, and now I come to with some standards. Don't let the dog drool on me. You know what I mean? Like, and I pass back out. I wake up in Canham County Correctional Facility October 2nd. I needed some sleep. I was up for quite a few days, and it wasn't Red Bull. And I came to in jail, and I didn't know how I got there. And the reason why I say that is because I was 15, and I come in the AA, I'd hear guys say, I woke up in a jail cell, and I didn't know how I got there. I tell myself, yo, dude, how you commit a crime, get locked up, go for a ride, go to sleep, wake up, and not know how you got there? Well, October 2nd, I woke up and didn't know how I got there. I'm thinking, oh, that's what they're talking about. Finally, I made it, you know? I got on my knees. There was two brothers and a Puerto Rican in that cell and me. You could tell how well I must blend in Canham County, right? And I get on my knees and I say the only prayer I know to say, God, please. And it was profanity-laced, but it went something like this. God, please remove the obsession to drink. Please. It wasn't get me bail, get out. You know, I didn't want to leave. If you ever find yourself in a position where you wake up in a jail cell and you don't know how you got there and you don't want to leave, oh, what a great start. I'm here to tell you. I couldn't get out of jail no more. I kept getting out. I kept coming back. I used to think because I wrote my name on the wall, I used to say the jail was sucking me back in. I never correlated all the crimes I was committing and they were coming to get me. I thought it was the jail had some kind of like centrifugal force that would pull me in. And because they would tell me that in jail and I believe it. And so I'd like to tell you that I went in there and I said that prayer and I was struck with my primary purpose. I started 12-stepping people in the jail. Nope. Anthony brought Mr. South Philly with him. Mr. Ego. So what does Anthony do? He triples up on commissary. What do the brothers in Canham County do? Beat the shit out of me and take it. So what do I got to do? I got to do it two more times because I got to prove something to the nuts in jail that I'm cool. And they beat the shit out of me two more times and take it. That's what I come with. Constantly worry what other people think. That's what I come to. So alcohol beat me in a state of reasonableness. And the brothers in Canham County Jail... beat my ego right into the ground, man. And here's the scary part. I wasn't paying no child support. I was a complete degenerate. And I was worried about what the nuts in jail thought of me. That's where this thing brought me. That's how low this thing brought me. And so I go through that. 7 months sober. My father comes to visit me at the very end, and he looks at me and he goes, "Come on, Ann, I want you to come to Bel Air, Maryland." I said, "Nah, I've been out there, dude. They're weird. Look at these people smoking electric cigarettes and stuff." I said, "Vaping, goofy stuff. Smoke a real cigarette. You know what I mean? I'm not part of that stuff. They're all young, talking about God in the steps. Nah." He said, "What's your plan, Ann?" I said, "Well, I met this 50-year-old Jewish lady before I went in. She's a millionaire and she loves me. She wants to take care of me. She's been writing me letters, sending me commissary." He says, "What?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Is she sober?" I go, "No, but she wants me to be sober. That she's going to drive me to meetings." Now, I've been away for a long time, but I ain't seen that face in a long time. Like, that face that looks back at you like, "What?" And I'm thinking, I said, "Oh, my God. I thought it was a good idea until I saw that look." I said, "All right, I'll go to Bel Air." And what ends up happening is I get out, I go to Bel Air, my mother gives me $2 a day and a pack of Newports, and I got to walk 2 miles a day to catch the bus to go to the noon meeting. Now, I love this noon meeting now because I get to go there for a different reason, look for people to help. But when you're dying untreated alcoholism, and some of these noon meetings are crazy. You know what I mean? And so if you ever did this, I'm about to offend you. I'm just telling you now. It was on step 6 and 7. I'm sitting in there. I'm 7 months stone dry, scared to death to go back to drinking. I have no relationship with God. Ain't never helped another person in my life. I'm dying. And I get there. And it's on step 6 and 7. And it turns into a road rage meeting. Everybody's gauging their humility and their defects of character by not giving a finger to somebody. I didn't mean to do that, by the way. Giving a finger to somebody to cut them off. 52 people talking about road rage in step 6 and 7 meeting. There's some good stuff at 6 and 7. How about a God have all me, good and bad, right? How about having just gone through the fifth step and finding out how objectionable selfishness and all that stuff is and my whole feeling? There's all kinds of gems. Anybody in here working on your character defects? Ever try that? I pick the wrong ones every time. I don't know how you do it. But it tells me in 7 that God have all me, good and bad, to remove from me every single defect that'll block me from being useful to you and others. I have no idea what's going to be good for me. I'm just coming out today, God. What are we doing? These nuts are talking about road rage, and they call me. So I proceed to tell them, "You need 3 things for road rage. A car, license, and a place to go. Don't know which 3 I have. I'm dying of alcoholism. Thanks, let me share." I still think I'm right. And they didn't call me for like another 3 months. And so I go and, you know, I had to a couple different sponsors, and I went through the steps a couple different ways. And every time I get a new experience, I tack the previous one, and I stopped doing that because I didn't understand the concept of a journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't understand that victory over these may bear witness to those I'd help, but I powered, I love, and I way of life. Right? I didn't understand things like that. My only concept of the third step was 4 through 9. That's it. Right? That's a great concept, moving through the steps. But I come back and I start looking at that third step, and it starts talking about victory over these may bear witness. Victory over what? All the shitty sobriety I had. Yeah, I had a lot of it. You know what? I tolerate people with shitty sobriety now too. You know, because I had it. You know what I mean? And I know where they're at. Right? And when I hear people saying stuff, I think to myself, I don't have to judge him. I can go up there and talk to him, share some of my experience, right? Love and tolerance is our code, correct? How do I get love and tolerance? By going through the stuff myself, man. Right? That's how I do it. I have no wasted mistakes in Alcoholics Anonymous. None. But I would always attack the previous experience. My AA has changed dramatically each time. And so anyway, I'm about a year ago, whatever it was, met this guy and sponsoring a lot of people. I think if I speak at a meeting and 30 of my friends come the next week, if I don't feel good, I should bring 40. That's how I'm treating my alcoholism, by road trips. And I finally find out what I'm suffering from. See, today I know now that I suffer from a spiritual condition, right? Spiritual disconnect. And I thought every time I came inside and outside Alcoholics Anonymous, in and out, that powerless meant what happened after I drank. And unmanageability is everything after I happened. And I always drank thinking that. And until somebody explained it to me, The unmanageability is where I'm at when I have no solution in me, when I have no drink, when I have no drug, when I'm in a state of irritable discontent and restless, a prey to misery and depression, right? When I'm sober. And when I'm powerless, I have the inability not to go back to something that's going to relieve that state. All of a sudden, the rest of the steps were no longer optional. Right? And I came to believe in that power, and I made a decision to unblock the things between me and God. Right? And then I got into 10 and 11 and 12. Right? And I'm going to tell you what. About 6 months ago, I was ready to drink. And I'm sponsoring a ton of people. I'm talking all over the damn place. I'm listening to 10 steps. And I ain't doing one. I had no principle of awareness throughout any part of my day. All my day was consistently thinking about me and what me had to do. And if I'm sponsoring you, I'm thinking about the next guy I got to sponsor. I'm in the middle of cutting crown molding. I wonder where my career's going. That's not a good time to be thinking about anything else other than what you're cutting, by the way. It's like $12 a linear foot. So I met this guy about a year ago, and he started talking to me about the principle of awareness and being my brother's keeper and my primary purpose, and that love comes from my heart. And really what ended up happening was, see, he used the first time I met him a word called paradigm. I ran. See, if I don't understand what you're saying, I'll insult you. I don't come in AA like if you scare me, I don't go, excuse me, sir, you're scaring me. I go, listen, buddy, I'll smack you. Get out of my way. You know what I mean? I don't come up to you and say, hey, buddy, will you put my hand in your hand and you put it in God's hand and help me get closer to help God's kids? No, I don't say that. And I was scared to death inside Alcoholics Anonymous up until about 2.5 years sober. I had a few awakenings, you know, I had a few content moments. But I still had no idea what my purpose was. And one of the biggest revelations I had in Alcoholics Anonymous was that my purpose is to be available to help God's kids. Right? And how do I do that? I unblock the things between me and that power, and then I start helping others do the same thing. You know how long I balked on amends? Some of the most freeing experiences I had. I made amends to my ex-wife about 3-4 months ago, and she's been missing, and I'm a single father, 13-year-old daughter, and a 14-year-old daughter, 12-year-old son. Fellowship helped me raise them kids. And she's been missing. But anyway, I made amends to her about 3 months ago, 4 months ago. She showed up, and I figured it's time to do it. And I looked at her, and I said, listen, I know we changed. I know I did a lot to harm you. And I need to know what you need me to do to make it right. And she looked at me, and she goes, can you just stop judging me and be my friend? And I'm looking at her, I'm going, oh. I mean, I didn't say this, but this is my thought. Really? Can't I just write a check? I know nobody else thinks like that. I'm going to tell you right now, I'm sick. But what came out of my mouth was yes. Because a week prior to that, when she showed up, I got the concept that God's a father, we're his children. She's my sister. Right? If you're ever suffering on that, page 67, the sick man's prayer. That prayer saved my life in a lot of cases. Helped me really change my perception. And what ended up happening was when I start looking at her as my sister, all of a sudden, that resentment went away, and I was available to help. And I stopped judging, right? And I have the privilege and the blessing to be a part of a lot of people's lives. I could really care less about the title sponsorship. I could care less about it. My job is to be available at any given time, at any moment, to be available for anybody and share love with that person. That's it. What's love? Love is enhancing each other's relationship to grow closer to God than me. That's my concept of it. How am I enhancing the other person's spiritual growth? Or how are we enhancing each other's? That's it. If nothing else I do, at least I can do is help somebody understand what alcoholism is, which is one of the best-kept secrets in Alcoholics Anonymous if you travel around a lot. Can't tell you how many people I meet and I ask them, you know what an alcoholic is? Yeah, I suck at drinking. Got anything else? Working with anything else here, Bo? No. All right. How many times you've come in with that concept? 52. You want to try another way? You know? And I've given a lot of crazy advice as a sponsor when I had no relationship with God. I had one guy come in one time. He said, I owe $3,000 to my veterinarian. This is when I was new. I said, declare bankruptcy. That's the kind of advice I used to give. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. You know what I mean? I told you I was a shitty member of AA. I'm telling you. But I learned from that. I learned not to give financial advice. The only advice I give today is based on spiritual principle. And we don't talk about other people.
I ain't no relationship therapist. I'm single. I suck at relationships. But, well, for my own kind. But I have beautiful relationships with people that are all over the place. And we share one thing, the enthusiasm for Alcoholics Anonymous and helping God's kids. You know, and today I know what my primary purpose is, and that's a beautiful thing to have. I always end with this. Listen, when I did my time in Camden County, I had not seen my kids for a year. My view from Camden County was the Ben Franklin Bridge to the right, the Walt Whitman to the left, and a beautiful view of Philadelphia. People pay about $1 million for that view. I was getting $8 a week for it. And below me, I could see the Camden River Sharks play every week, play every night, and they would set off fireworks. My wildest dream was to see my kids every other weekend. That was it. And I get out of jail, and a few months later, I get full custody of them, and the fellowship helped me raise them kids, and we get a little house, and it's open. We've had wet drunks on the couch since I've had the place. We take people in. My daughter's like a triage nurse in AA. My son could qualify it better than most people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're AA kids. And about 7-8 months ago, we're selling that damn Boy Scout popcorn, which I'm sorry if you had to buy it because it's ridiculously expensive. I thought the Girl Scouts were getting bad. Man, it's a $16 bag of popcorn, this stuff. And so anyway, we do go in and we get these tickets to a AAA baseball game. And I'm out in Maryland, and the tickets were at the Camden River Sharks. And I get to go to that stadium, and I get to camp out in the field with my son. And I get to lay on that field and watch them fireworks go off over my head and look at that building that I used to sit in looking out of, looking at that field, wondering if I'd ever see my kids again, man. And I was laying on that field watching them fireworks, crying with my son because I could not believe what this thing has given me back. Do you know that I don't work on myself? I don't do that. The constant collision I found inside my life is working on myself. And the minute I start putting this thing on a service plane and worrying about God's kids and not myself, me, my children, and my family have reunited. My job is beautiful. It's conducive to AA and all my traveling. My children have aunts and uncles they could have never got anywhere else. My mother is one of the happiest mothers in the world right now. She's got both her sons sober inside Alcoholics Anonymous, and she could sleep tonight. This thing has radically changed my life. Radically changed my life. I couldn't get sober, and why I laugh when I say I didn't pick my sobriety date, because it's true. I was given an unmerited gift, which is God's grace. And the only thing I can do to pay that back is by helping God's kids. That is it. Any kids at any time, at any moment. Don't even have to be an alcoholic. And I've just been blessed in a lot of different areas. And I'll tell you what, I'm having a ball in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're sitting here tonight and you're still on the I Need a Meeting program, please come talk to me after, because there's another way. And I know there's a lot of happy people in here. And this is an absolute beautiful group. Absolute beautiful. To see a pocket of enthusiasm milk Quakertown. It's absolutely beautiful. I did live in Hatfield briefly. I was not too far from here. I made the Hatfield Courier Times front page. I was only here 3 months. They really dress it up out of it. I did like a little cocaine and something else. You know what I mean? A front page, you know. I wouldn't even have gotten the Daily News in Philly. Out here, it was front page. My father got a fax to him at work. He didn't like that in Telford. He wasn't happy about that one. He chased me for 3 months. So I've woke up in a lot of places. And today I get to be awake every day. All right? And I got some principles in my life to help me stay awake. And this is a beautiful fellowship, and I want to thank Rich for having me out here, and thank you guys for listening. And I love you all. Thank you.